Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Hello, and welcome back to the GeoMob Podcast. Today, we're talking about trees, but not just any old trees. We're discussing how to map trees outside of woodlands at a countrywide scale. To do this, I have Freddie Hunter with me from the from Forest Research. Hi there, Freddie. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
No worries. Maybe we can start with you introducing yourself to the listeners and a little bit about Forest Research as well.
That's great. Like Alistair said, I'm Freddie Hunter, and I run the remote sensing team at IFOS. Forest Research has various sort of centres within it, and my team sits within IFOS, which is the Inventory, Forecasting, and Operational Support division. I've been at Forest Research for nearly 4 years now, and I've been running the team for coming up for 2 years now. Prior to that, I was a contractor. I had my own company called Cloud-Free Metrics, and I had various contracts with government programs and with some colleagues in Eastern Africa, Northeast Africa, where I was involved in conservation research and also in carbon analysis, shall we say. And prior to that, I was a software engineer or sort of data scientist or data engineer, whatever you want to call it, at forest-based remote sensing startup in Edinburgh. And that was the sort of start of my career. But before that, I was in conservation and ecological genetics research and evolutionary biology before that as well. So I've sort of I've had a winding career, originally starting in biology and sort of ending up in remote sensing, which I think is just an amazing technology. Still find it really interesting.
Wow. It sounds like there's a whole separate podcast to have about like what you were doing before you started doing what you're doing now. Cool. So it sounds like trees have always been a thing that you've been interested in, or is it just sort of like nature generally that you're interested in?
Trees have always been interesting to me, but I think that I only started to think about them from a work perspective when I was a data scientist at Global Surface Intelligence, which I don't think it exists anymore. But we used remote sensing to produce forest non-forest maps in North America and tree density maps, tree species maps in North America. I also did my master's dissertation on mapping plant species in savannas, which obviously includes lots of acacia species and things like that. So yeah, I sort of got into trees via conservation, and then as a sort of developer for I guess we call them forest inventory maps, which to try and document just how many species at different age classes exist within someone's property, specifically in North America. That's sort of how I got into this, and then when I came to Forest Research, I came to it from a more policy monitoring, government statistics side of things. So while I wouldn't consider myself to be a particularly knowledgeable forester, I have picked up a lot of forestry knowledge over my years, but I'm principally a remote sensing data person rather than a forester.
Excellent, cool. So we're going to be talking about trees outside woodlands. So what's special about this data set, and what was the driver for it, and you know, why is it needed?
We need this trees outside of woodlands data set because essentially the government monitors tree coverage across the nation using principally the National Forest Inventory, which is the forest research map, which we produce every year based on remote sensing as well. Although my team don't specifically produce that map. But that map is specific to all woodland that is 0.5 hectares and larger, with a canopy cover percentage of at least 20%. The criteria also includes a minimum width of 20 meters. So these are sort of parcels of forestry as sort of you might think about traditionally. But there's also a huge amount of tree canopy which exists outside of that definition, and that is not monitored or mapped on an annual basis. We know from previous studies, there was a big study by Forest Research in 2017, which estimated that there was approximately 550 hectares of canopy which existed outside the National Forest Inventory. And that sort of report is only produced every now and again, I think, you know, every 5 years at most, probably longer than that. So those maps, those estimates are produced from, you know, sampling estimates. They're a lot of sort of manual digitization and sampling. It's not a complete coverage map. It's not a complete extent, for example. It's very much a statistically derived estimate of how much canopy exists outside the National Forest Inventory woodland map. And that number is very large. And especially people are much more interested in trees in the current political climate than they used to be. So there's been a lot of government direction and funding towards better resolution mapping, better statistics, more accurate statistics. And the obvious place for us to focus was in this trees outside of woodlands aspect, because we know that in England it represents at least 30% of canopy cover. And it's you know, not being reported on an annual basis. It's not being protected particularly well. So there's huge scope for both mapping potential, statistics, and protection for this component of forestry, which has been overlooked for many decades.
Okay, cool. So just so we're clear for the listeners as well, so we're not talking about hedgerows, but we are talking about individual trees that might be within hedgerows. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, just to jump the gun a little bit, we are releasing a hedgerow map of England within the next 12 months, hopefully before that, and that will be integrated with the Trees Outside of Woodlands map. So that's really exciting. That's one of the things we've been working on this year, amongst various other improvements and updates to the map. But yes, as the map currently stands, which was published on the 5th of April, we are talking about lone trees, groups of trees, and small woodlands, which have an area up to a maximum of 0.5 of a hectare, because otherwise they're considered part of woodland rather than trees outside of woodland. But yes, because of various methodological requirements, there are trees which exist within hedgerows. Yes, for example, you had a hedgerow that's 2 meters tall, for example, and you have a tree that's 3, maybe 3.5 meters tall. It will appear as a lone tree, not a tree embedded in a hedgerow. So that's one of the things that we're trying to get at, because obviously there are ecologically important aspects to lone trees. And if you're doing some analysis and you're using the map and you're saying filter for lone trees, you may well be including many trees that are embedded in other vegetation, and that might not be the sort of criteria you're interested in. For example, I have a colleague who's only interested in lone trees within pasture and agricultural land, so they have no sort of direct contact with any other tree-like vegetation, whereas obviously a lone tree embedded in a hedge is very much not alone in the same way as a pastoral oak tree or something might be.
Okay, cool. And whilst we're on definitions and things, so is there a specific definition of what a group of trees is? I mean, I've got an idea in my head of what a group of trees might look like, but I'm just wondering if there's an ecological description.
Well, so definitions are inherently very difficult, especially when it comes to the natural world, as anyone who has a degree in biology will know. But in this instance, a lone tree is a tree that doesn't touch the canopy of any other tree which is in the Trees Outside of Woodlands map. So it may well touch the canopy of a smaller tree that is too small to be in the map. Obviously, I can't account for that. But ultimately, a lone tree needs to not touch any other feature. And it may be millimeters away from the nearest object, but provided it's isolated in the map, it counts as a lone tree. You may wish to put a buffer of, say, 10 meters and say that's your definition. But within the map currently, that's all that's required. For a group of trees, obviously, we need to count more than one. But the group of trees transitions to a small woodland at the 0.1 hectare size threshold. So you go from a group of trees to a heap of trees, specifically at 0.1 hectare, which is a definition that was previously used by colleagues at Forest Research. For example, back in the 2017 report, this definition was clarified, or it may have even been used before then. So I didn't redesign a lot of these metrics. For example, we'll be introducing an additional woodland type that will be linear groups of trees, right. And a linear group of trees will need to be 4 times longer than it is wide, which I think is a slightly arbitrary definition, but again, it's something that's been used in the past, and just no good reason to come up with anything else, I suppose. Like I said, definitions are difficult. So if someone else has already defined one and there's research already using it, then I think that's reason enough to adopt the pre-existing definition. So yeah, we'll have more woodland types in the future, as well as when the hedgerow map is integrated, we'll obviously have trees within hedgerows, we'll have groups of trees within hedgerows, and we'll have linear groups of trees. So there are quite a few things on the horizon.
That's really cool. So having come from a background of sort of land cover mapping myself, I just love the fact that people get in a room and start hammering out these definitions that are really, really specific about things. It's brilliant.
They are. You know, it can be quite tricky, yep.
Yeah, definitely. So could you explain a little bit about how the data set was created? So what sort of tools you were using and what data went into creating the Trees Outside Woodland data set?
Of course. So the principal data set for the Trees Outside Woodlands map is the National LiDAR Survey, which was completed by the Environment Agency. So this is a plane that flies up down the country with a laser, and the laser basically counts how long it takes for the pulse to leave the sensor and bounce off an object and come back. So it's sort of telemetry, if you like. And so you get a three-dimensional representation of the ground. This LiDAR is quite low quality. I think it's about 1 point per square meter. And you can get, say, thousands of points per square meter at the high quality level. Mm-hmm. So that means this data, it's very good in terms of the accuracy of the height information that you get. But there's a sort of, should we say, noise or a coarseness to it as well, which is not quite so helpful. It was primarily collected for hydrological purposes. But essentially, you know, we can delineate, we can define a minimum height of 2.5 meters and then delineate all objects above that height. However, that obviously includes buildings, high-sided vehicles, all kinds of things. So that needs to be removed. So the Environment Agency went one step further than they cleaned their own National LiDAR data set to attempt to include only vegetation, which is obviously what we're interested in. So they developed a model called the Vegetation Object Model, which is essentially a tau map, except that it's a raster rather than a vector data set. It contains all trees rather than just Trees Outside of Woodlands, and also contains vegetation that might not be trees, for example. So we needed to essentially take that data set and filter it further. For example, we removed more objects that were erroneously included using things like sublittoral rock maps, or we looked for where caravan sites were and solar farms. We looked for open data sets that might point to more updated building extents. For example, open street map, I believe. Yeah. You know, things like that, just to try to remove further some of the objects that might have existed in the vegetation object model. But ultimately, that was our foundational data set, and it was actually extremely good. So that National LiDAR data set is relatively old now. Unfortunately, it spans a range of 2017 till 2021. At least the original data set does. However, some patches are continually updated by the Environment Agency, and we will try to incorporate those updates into the map as well to try and get some change detection or improve quality. But ultimately, the first release of the map does represent a relatively old National LiDAR dataset. On top of that, we did try to use more optical datasets, for example, Sentinel-2, things like that, which is an optical satellite provided by the European Space Agency. So using NDVI filters and other vegetation indices, we can try to also detect objects that are not vegetation or not tree-like. For example, gorse is quite yellow, broom is quite yellow. We don't really want that in our map. It doesn't constitute tree, forest, or tree, or the definition of a tree, where the definition is it needs to be able to have the potential to reach 5 meters tall, for example, and it needs to be not a shrub. For example, rhododendron is not considered it shouldn't be included in the map, and it shouldn't be included in the National Forest Inventory. It doesn't meet our standards for forest or woodland or tree. It's fundamentally a shrubbery, bush, something else. It doesn't have the capacity to reach 5 meters. I'm sure the odd rhododendron bush probably does, but it's not a tree. But yeah, okay. Those are the kinds of data sets that we used. And the software for developing the map, we used AWS clusters, EC2 instances to parallelize large data processing algorithms, primarily using R packages like Simple Features, which is fantastic, the Terra raster package, and also GDAL, the geospatial abstraction library, which is for terminals. There was also some Python involved as well, using things like NumPy, packages like NumPy and GeoPandas. They're fairly sort of standard. I don't think we were doing anything particularly complicated here. I think we were just doing something with a large data set. And we were just doing something that hadn't been funded before. There's nothing particularly revolutionary about the way that we did this. It's more that we did it and it looks good and it's, it appears to have passed all the sort of requirements and science assurance policies and things like that. You know, it's something that really should have been done a while ago, and I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time and have the opportunity to produce the map. There was a previous map produced by a colleague who existed at Forest Research before me, and that first iteration was built upon by myself, shall we say. There have been a few people involved in the production of this map, but ultimately I was able to make use of some more simpler and standard tools, which were actually more effective than trying to use machine learning, classifications, and this kind of thing. They were actually less successful than a more sort of traditional algorithmic approach, which is ultimately what we went with.
That's interesting finding in its own right, is that, using some of those filtering options and some of the sort of algorithmic packages and things, it gives you the answer that you want. Doesn't always have to be about machine learning and AI. And
There's no statistical modeling. It's very step-by-step process, data processing in a very traditional way. However, this may not be true now. Using the same data sets, I think that... If I'd done this the same process now, I would have done a slightly different approach. But I can talk about that in the updates question, I suppose.
Yeah, that'd be useful. I was just gonna. So there's a couple of questions that came out of that. So one is, could you just say what the spatial resolution is of the input data? Because I think that will help people understand why you were using AWS and things like that to process it.
So the National LiDAR Survey from the Environment Agency is a 1 meter resolution. So if we look at the entire nation of England, you have 100 and I can't remember exactly what the number is, but it's about 150,000 1 by 1 kilometer squares, and you need to process every single one of them, essentially. So we batch processed the map in 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer tiles, which means you need 150,000. And I think that the processing actually only took about 3 weeks on AWS and probably didn't cost very much either. So that was huge. That was hugely efficient. For any sort of high resolution map like that, it's kind of essential. We also needed to do various things like buffering, and then reducing the number of vertices in polygons to try and reduce the size of the data set. And so things like that can massively improve the processing time and reduce the size of your data set ultimately. I think we reduced the size of the data set by sort of like 5 or 6 fold by reducing the number of vertices that were initially implemented from a buffering function.
Okay, cool. And then my other question from that was going to be, is your team quite a big user of R? Is that sort of one of the technologies that you guys coalesce around?
Yes, I mean, Forest Research in general is a big user of R. I think it comes mostly from an academic background. A lot of the academics are better R users than Python users. But I also have two team members who can't speak R. They only speak Python, so it's not a requirement to join my team. obviously it helps with code review in hopes of everyone's sort of understands the same process. But on a weekly basis, we have code reviews and everyone learns how we all code and how we all interpret the languages differently. I think it's a great tool and it worked well for this. You know, like I said, I wasn't doing anything particularly innovative, I don't think. Nothing particularly complicated, just about the data volumes required and obviously getting the definitions and things and the approval required to produce a government standard and government official product. There's a bureaucracy behind it as well, and you need to get everything to work in order to release something like this. And that's, as a whole package, that's a lot more complicated than just writing data processing algorithms.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's something that I guess quite a lot of people don't necessarily think about when they're processing these things, is the need to go through that official process of getting it released. I'm sort of quite interested in how the dataset's been used, either within forest research or by, if you know of other users who've been using it. Has anyone been using it in an innovative way? Have they found anything new about tree ecology that maybe you didn't know before?
We have a number of projects at Forest Research that are using the map. One is trying to quantify carbon within trees outside of woodlands, which is, if anyone knows anything about allometric equations, it's extremely difficult to do for trees that are not within woodland. They have a different relationship with carbon. So that's one of our projects at the moment, is to estimate the carbon content within each tau feature. So that'll be great, and that'll go towards the, the greenhouse gas inventory, for example. Okay. We have other projects looking at how the distribution of lone trees varies across the country, and try to use that information to initiate tree planting strategies and try and restore trees outside of woodlands or enhance it in local areas. For example, there's this, I can't exactly remember the rule, but you should be able to see at least three trees and three green spaces from your window. I can't remember. There's some sort of rule, and you can use the map to basically find out which houses in the UK, in England, are deprived of this requirement. It's not a sort of requirement, it's a sort of like best, you know, in an ideal world, you should be able to see two green spaces and three trees from your window. And you can use the trees that are in the maps to find areas in especially urban areas, obviously, which are deprived, and therefore to try and target tree planting and general green space improvement in those areas. So that's a really nice, easy, clean use case for local councils, for example. I particularly like that one. Then we also have the Department for Environment are the funders of the map. They funded the map under the NCEA program, and the NCEA program stands for the Natural Capital and Ecosystem Assessment program, and that's been running for, I think, 4 or 5 years now, and it's going to be extended until next year. So they're the main funders of the map, and they have the Department for Environment have a Trees and Woodlands policy group, and they use the map extensively for tree planting targeting, for example. So they themselves have a very deep use case for the map itself. And then on top of that, we have the official statistics, which we're releasing every 2 to 3 years, which are based on the map. And those statistics relate to the total canopy cover within trees outside of woodlands, that estimate is calibrated using ground truth data, for example. So the map has various sort of official functions, and then, you know, organizations, community forests, for example. I have endless emails from community forests, or at least I did before I published the map, looking for data, because they wanted to produce their plans for where to plant the trees, where was lacking, and they needed the town map data to make their plans. And they knew the map was coming out soon, but it never seemed to arrive. So just endless emails from community forests looking for specific excerpts from the map, which I was largely happy to give out and help them with their planning. So they've been a big user of the data as well.
Oh, cool. That's really good to hear, because I was going to say there's a community group or community forest group near me called Avon Needs Trees, just doing quite a lot of work. And I was thinking, oh, this would be a brilliant data set for them, but I'm sure they're already on it because they do seem very, very organized.
I think I have some emails from them and they'll have had early access to the data.
So we've talked about sort of what's in the data set and how it's been processed and the fact that it covers the whole of England. I mean, to me, my main question is, how on earth do you quality assess a data set that's that large in its geographic extent, given that it's a relatively sparse data set, I'm guessing? I mean, you're looking at trees that you would need, I'm thinking that you would probably need to do quite a lot of traveling to do any sort of QA if you wanted to do it on the ground, or were you using other methods?
Yeah, on the ground. So I guess I'll preempt the question by saying that we have an entire program dedicated to this kind of thing. So we have the town map, which is its own project, and then we have the Trees Outside of Woodlands survey. And one of the functions of the survey is to provide accuracy and calibration statistics for the map, as well as to collect additional information on Trees Outside of Woodlands in terms of the species, for example, the health of the trees, the condition of the trees, various, you know, forestry metrics like the diameter breast height, the height of the trees, various things that we don't have in the map but are useful pieces of data, because of course we have surveys of forest but we don't have surveys of trees outside of Woodlands, which contain this kind of information. But fundamentally, some of that data goes towards trying to improve the map itself, or just trying to provide validation statistics and accuracy statistics. So one of the processes involved in the survey is to take an aerial photograph, a recent one, and manually digitize the canopy areas and label them with lone tree, group of trees, smaller woodlands. And then we can take those, they're 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer, and we can compare those to the map and say what is the difference. Okay. What's the percentage difference, what are the woodland types, how do they break down, for example. So we had a few hundred of those across the country, and I think at this point we have over 1,000. So I'll be continuing to update the analysis when we have more and more samples, because as everyone knows, the more samples you have, the more robust your statistics. So at this point, yes, we have considerably more than we did when I conducted the original accuracy assessment. But overall, we have I recently did some analysis in an urban area, and I found that there was only a 1% difference in the total area between the verification or digitized canopy and the town map. So that was a great finding. The accuracy of the lone trees versus group of trees is less accurate, but fundamentally, from a official statistics point of view, we're mostly interested in the total area, and that only had a 1% discrepancy. So we're pretty happy with that.
That's amazing. Yeah. So you've already sort of alluded to it, but are there plans for updates to the data set?
Yes, definitely. My plan is ultimately to produce an annual map, which will represent an update in terms of the canopy extent. So obviously, every year we lose trees. There's been some well-publicized lone trees that we've lost, for example. But there is also a huge amount of loss of groups of trees in small woodlands to things like road development, HS2, for example, infrastructure, all manner of sort of modern developments take out trees outside of woodlands. And what's unfortunate about this is that trees outside of woodlands tend to be native broadleaf, old habitat types. And these are fundamentally the things that we're missing most in British or English landscape. So I'm interested in monitoring the loss of trees associated with infrastructure and providing that information annually. But I'm also interested in obtaining what's new. You know, trees get planted, trees grow, and ultimately trees expand their own canopy. So I'm interested in detecting that as well. So in future, the plan is to release an updated baseline every year. Obviously, because the aerial photography is captured on a 3-year rolling update, it's sort of a patchwork of updates. So you won't expect to find all of 2024, for example, next year, or all of 2025 in the year after. It will be a patchwork of updates, and that should be clear in the data itself, which areas have been updated, which ones are still from the same previous data set. But ultimately, we'll be updating the map using a synthetic canopy height model, which has been developed by the World Resources Institute in association with Meta. They've produced an incredible canopy height model, which can be derived directly from aerial photography. So you feed in a two-dimensional RGB image, and you get out what looks like, you know, a LiDAR survey of only the trees. So buildings are not in it. Cars are not in it, roads are not in it, bridges are not in it. It just delineates and gives a height estimate for canopy foliage, and it's incredibly accurate. It's the latest estimate from my colleague at World Resources Institute is that it's a 1.2 mean absolute error, which is incredible from a two-dimensional image. So we've been working with them to sort of calibrate their model and generate some accuracy statistics using some of our LiDAR. By using the aerial photography, I'm hoping that we will be able to detect tree expansion and tree planting when they reach the minimum height of 3 meters and a minimum area of 5 meters squared. So obviously it's incremental, but some trees must reach that threshold every year, and they should be included in the map. Also, you know, there will have been trees missed by the LiDAR due to its coarse nature, especially in urban environments where, you know, you've got a sort of medium small tree up against the side of a building, that kind of thing. Those trees will often have been missed. That's probably our largest source of error. And I'm hopeful that this synthetic canopy height layer based on 12.5 centimeter aerial photography will allow us to fill in a lot of those gaps. So in some ways it's frustrating because the next release of the map will undoubtedly contain a lot more canopy than the previous one, probably, I don't know, 10 to 15% possibly, which, you know, hopefully won't lead too many people to assume that every year we have a 15% increase in trees, that sort of ones. But, you know, fundamentally, we have an issue in science in general, which is that, you know, you produce a data set and then you get asked to produce the data set again, and it's methodologically different from the previous one. And so it's very difficult to quantify which changes are methodological and which changes are genuine systematic changes in what you're trying to measure. So it can be frustrating to try and argue with policymakers about the true extent of forest gain and forest loss, because you're trying to sort of negate the big changes by saying that it's a methodological change rather than a real world change. That's one of the challenges, I guess, in remote sensing in general, is that technological advancement means that you're just constantly updating your processes and getting a better and better product. And while you're hopeful that you're slowly minimizing error over time, it's just hard to compare year on year changes when the methodologies keep getting better and better.
Yeah, I guess as well, to some respect, that the more people you get using the map and the data, hopefully the more sort of local knowledge you'll have around certain specific areas where they're using it. And if there's anything that they think is a little bit odd, I would hope they would get in touch with you and say, like, oh, what's going on in this area? And then that also informs the way in which you do any updates, or informs what bits of the methodology might need to be tweaked and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we don't get a thousand emails saying you've missed a tree in my garden, which was exactly what happened when we initially released the data set, was that everyone was having a look at their back garden. I'm always happy to receive feedback. It can be very difficult to be very specific. You know, why is this tree in the data set and this tree not in the data set? For example, a lot of the orchards are not in the Trees Outside of Woodlands map, because a lot of them, especially modern day orchards, aren't very tall. They're essentially sort of hedges, if you like. And while I guess orchard managers like to think that they've got a forest, according to our definition, and they're not tall enough to be in the map. So you'll see, you know, rows and rows of fruit trees, and they won't be in the map because they haven't been tall enough. So they're not very happy about that, for example.
That's a really interesting edge case. It's been amazing listening to you talk about what you get up to at Forest Research. I mean, I feel like we've only touched on one project, and that there's a whole host of other really amazing sort of tree and woodland based geo projects that we could talk about. If our listeners want to know more about this specific topic, how can they get in touch with you or the team or the project?
You can email the Forest Research remote sensing team at remote.sensing@forestresearch.gov.uk, and I will ultimately get your email filtered down to me. Feel free to message me on LinkedIn. Alternatively, we have a whole host of contacts available on the Forest Research website. I think it shouldn't be too difficult to get in contact with my team. And there's plenty of information out there about the map as well. If you look at the data sharing platform, the DSP, the DEFRA DSP, you can search for many of our forestry outputs. For example, we have a tree species map for England, which again, we're hoping to do another update for next year. That data set and its report are available on the DSP, as well as the Trees Outside of Woodlands data set itself, and the methodological and accuracy report are also available on the DSP. I think that there's also an email at the bottom of those reports as well.
Excellent. And I'll make sure that there's a link to the DSP and this data set in the show notes as well. Freddie, it's been brilliant, really insightful. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast and talking to us about it.
No problem. It's been great to chat to you today. Thanks a lot.
Brilliant. Cheers.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.